Hello, everyone. You get kind of a lull this time of year, don't you? I mean, we do not observe the days that are observed by so much of the world, but many of us, including myself, get time off this time of year. And what a year it's been, really. We've had some losses that have hit pretty hard. This is my sermon. there's 15 minutes left. So I just want to go over with you some thoughts that I have had at the end of the year, which often happens because there is time to sit and think. And I do think of things like Mark was mentioning, all the people who we're praying for, and they do need our prayers. I know little Allie Baker. Adelaide is a granddaughter of some friends of ours, and like thousands of people, I've tried to stay in touch with her. She's three, so I stay in touch with her parents, really. But there's so many people who mean so much to us, and sometimes things can get you down a little bit, particularly at a time when the days are shorter. The less light there is, again, the easier it is to wonder if you're doing things right. And you see the tide of the world turning against you, and you see all the things that Mr. Scapura correctly pointed out, where the direction the world is going, and you think, what am I doing? What if I'm wrong? What am I? Am I on the right track? And, of course, we come to services every week, and that's supposed to bolster us, and we help each other through that kind of thing. But sometimes you just sit and wonder, am I doing the right thing? Is this the right way of life? Is what we call God's way of life the right way to go? I mean, my family says, no, it's not. I mean, my extended family, my siblings and my parents. As a matter of fact, their exact words were, I got pretty good grades in school. I was pretty high in my class in high school and college and things like that. And I think my dad said, my brother Nell said, how could anybody as smart as Mark be as dumb as to be in that church? And I'm sure you've been on the receiving end of comments like that yourself. But it makes you wonder yourself. You have your own relationship with God, and that is something that strengthens you. But you want something that tells you you're on the right track. And I'm going to just tell you a few things that I always think of when I have those questions inside, which for some reason tend to come at this time of year. Because we see people like Mrs. Hargrove, who was as nice a person as you could ever know, a woman who lived a life of kindness and graciousness and beauty, and she's taken from us suddenly. And you want to recalibrate your life and see if you're on the right track. So let us have the scales fall from our eyes, as Mr. Scapura was talking about, and just look at a few random things, and they are random, folks. I'll tell you, this is four things that come to mind that make me think about being on the right track. And one is that if you were coming to the earth for the first time and had never seen it before, and you were analyzing the way people lived and the way the world worked, you would come across a very curious fact, and that is that the entire world keeps something called, the entire world, every human being on the earth keeps something called the Sabbath. They keep something called the seventh day Sabbath. And you think, they do not. You know, are you crazy? But it depends on what you mean by keeping the Sabbath, of course. And everybody in the world, the Chinese people, the Pope, the people in Australia, the Indians of South America, the indigenous peoples in New Zealand, Muslims in the Middle East and in other parts of the world, everywhere on the North Pole, if we have scientists there, on the South Pole, the people who live there, they all have a calendar that has a seven-day week. And I think that God must look at that and just chuckle. Just say, I won that round. Because there is no reason for the whole world to observe a seven-day week except the fact that God gave it to us. People who've tried to prove the Sabbath have tried to show that there are seven-day rhythms, but you know what? There aren't. There really are not. The only reason that the world keeps a seventh-day week, even people who don't like seven-day weeks, is because God gave that seven-day week to man at some point, and it was because God created the world in 7 days. And so Vladimir Putin, when he gets up and sees that today is Saturday, he knows that tomorrow is going to be the first day of the week and the next day is going to be the second day of the week. He's proclaiming that there was at one point a seven-day week of creation. And do you know something else interesting is that most people in the world know that today is the Sabbath? I want to read a list to you. I collect, and I'm confessing this to you because we're friends, and I know you won't make fun of me. Never. But one of the things that I collect and I have a whole shelf of is I love pop-up books. Not I don't mean necessarily little babies' pop-up books, but books where artists, you open them up and this amazing thing pops up in front of your eyes, whether it's a sailing ship or a city or something like that. I open those things up and I get a lot of joy out of that. And my favorite artist is a man named Robert Sabuda. Robert Sabuda, his name means Bob Sabbath. That's exactly what it means. I work on harpsichords, and harpsichords are a musical instrument, and one of the best harpsichord workers and makers in the world is a man named Robert Sabbath, Sabatil. His name is Bob Sabbath. And they have these names because these names came from their cultures. But it's really like being named Bob Saturday or something like to them. I want to read you the word for Saturday in 24 different languages. In Arabic, the word is Sabet. Now, Muslims observe a Friday day of, I don't know if they call it a day of rest. They don't call it a Sabbath. But on the seventh day of the week, they call Sabet, what religion they are. The Armenians call it Shabbat. The Bosnians call it Sabota. Bulgarians call it Sabota. Corsicans call it Sabatu. Croatians, please forgive me, Raspoviches, but I have it spelled as Subota. Czech, Sobota. Georgian, Sabati. Greek, Sabato. Indonesian, Sabtu. Italian, Sabato. The Pope calls the seventh day of the week, Sabato. I don't know why I'm fixating on sixth day of the week. The Pope calls the seventh day of the week Sabbath. Latin, Sabbatum, if you know people who speak Latin. Maltese people, your little dog calls it is Sibit. Polish people, Sabota. Portuguese, Sabado. Romanian, Sambata. Russian, Subota. Serbian, Subota. Slovak, Sabota. Slovene, Sabota. Somali, Sabti. Spanish, Sabado. Sudanese, Sabtu. Ukrainian, Subota. So when Jesus comes back to earth and says, we're going to start observing a seventh day, he can say, what do you mean you didn't know about this? What's the name of the seventh day of the week? And they'll say, Sabbath. And he'll go, you're right. So I always think that God must laugh about that. I know I certainly do. That all the people who think that you're crazy for keeping a seventh day Sabbath, call it the Sabbath day. I think that's one of those funny little clues. Now, if I may be so incorrect, all the cool people have flown town, as you can see. It's just us today. There's very few children here. So I want to point out something very strange in this world. Again, if you came from outer space and you saw this world, do you know, I don't know whether you're aware of this practice, but do you know that there are cultures, there are parents who have little babies born to them, and one of the first things they do with that little baby is cut off a piece of them? Did you know that that happens? Did you know that parents are allowed to do that legally? It sounds like a barbaric custom. It's only the boys. It's only supposed to be the boys. And the world would tell you that that's a Jewish custom. But do you know what countries have the highest rates of circumcision? They are the English-speaking countries of the world. England, Canada, the United States, the Australians not so much, but the Australians are crazy about so many things. We don't even want to necessarily include them in our statistics. I fall into the camp of boys who were circumcised. Now, you know more about me than you ever wanted to know at this point. But many of you do too. And the reason I did was, and this is a wonder to me, is that I was born in an Air Force hospital in Germany. And my mother was not asked, it was simply done. Because These peoples, the English-speaking peoples, simply do it. And there is no reason to do it. You do not have to do it in the Church of God. Your baby sons do not have to be circumcised. Do you know why it's in the world as a common practice? Do you know the only reason that it's in the world as a common practice? Because the great eternal God gave it to a servant of his named Abraham as a sign. Now, later it was made clear to us that it's not something we have to do, that the spiritual aspect of is what's important. But the physical part of it was part of being the nation of Israel, and so people did that. It's a very weird practice when you think about it, and, you know, it doesn't matter. We don't have to be for it or against it. The point is that it exists. And the only reason it exists is because there's a being higher than we are who, for some reason of his own, introduced it to the world. And it has lived on, not just in the Jewish peoples, but in peoples who say they have nothing to do with the covenant of Abraham. And yet they still do that kind of thing. The third thing, and this is history. You know, Mark was talking about Sodom and Gomorrah. He was talking about things that happened with Samson. And these things are stories that we know to be true. But we can't really prove them historically, because what we call history, really, things were unwritten back then. And what we have is stories that were given to us at a much later time that were written down. We think many of them were written down by Moses, probably 1,700 years before Jesus was born. We're not real sure of that. But the point is, so much of the Bible, especially in the book of Genesis, are just things that you have to accept because Jesus and God say that they actually happened. However, you get to a certain point, and the Bible story starts intersecting with actual recorded history. And I don't mean just recorded history written with pens on paper. I mean recorded history where people chiseled things into stone and built buildings and built cities and built towers and carved the names of kings into them and things. I don't know how familiar you are with the books. Let's turn to them. They're before the book of Job. But they are the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And don't worry, we're not going to read them. All we're going to do is stare at them. Because Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther are some of the... We know the story of Esther pretty well because that's a very dramatic one. It's a nice one that we can tell our children. It's very uplifting. It has all kinds of excitement in it, and it ends very happily, at least for Esther and Mordecai, not for everybody else in the story. But for Esther, Mordecai, and their people, it ends very happily. So we know that story. But do you know the story of Ezra and Nehemiah? Ezra and Nehemiah were two men who were part of the Babylon captivity. They weren't necessarily alive when the nation of Judah was moved to Babylon. But they lived in Babylon. They grew up in Babylon. They knew the governments in Babylon, and it was more than one government. You know, it was Nebuchadnezzar who took the nation of Judah to Babylon, but his kingdom crumbled at the end of his life, and it became the kingdom of the Persians. And there were other kings named Darius and Cyrus and Xerxes, Artaxerxes. Xerxes was always a favorite of mine because, you know, there's so many X's in that. It was just a very weird word when we learned history in school. But these are actual historical figures. You can go to the British Museum, or you can go to a museum in Berlin. You can see buildings that they built, stones that were carved in their reign. You can see their names on documents. And these people, Darius and Cyrus and Artaxerxes, are mentioned in these two books. I recommend that, you know, you're always trying to figure out what you're going to study next in the Bible. These are short books. Ezra and Nehemiah, read them, because it's unbelievable what happens. Here's what happens in a nutshell. You know that the kingdom of Judah was conquered and taken to Babylon. They were persecuted and mocked people. They were not considered anything to admire. They were people who had done things wrong, and God himself says that he punished them by letting them go into that captivity. But while they were there, of course, they built their own lives. They had families, they had gardens, they had businesses, they had their form of worship at that point. But at some point, the king Cyrus, the king Darius, and the king Artaxerxes all were convinced that these people had to go back to Jerusalem and build a temple. And not just build a temple, but the kings gave them money to build the temple, unlimited money. And when people in that area fought against them and persecuted them and tried to get them to abandon that work and contacted the kings and said, what's going on? The kings substantiated what they said and sent soldiers with Ezra and Nehemiah to protect them while this went on. The story is unbelievable. And as I said, this is the point in Israel's history where it starts to intersect with what the world calls real history. This is where you can go see things in museums. We aren't privy to the inner thoughts of Darius and Cyrus and Artaxerxes except in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, but we know that they existed, and we know that under their rule, people went back from Babylon to Jerusalem, that a temple was rebuilt, and that that temple lasted until it was rebuilt again by Herod in the time of Jesus Christ. And that is so much of a miracle that those three kings who did not need to support the nation of Judah in any way changed their minds and made that happen. When you read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, and as I said, if you've already seen Star Wars, you know you'll be looking for a story. These are good stories. Not all the Bible is good stories. It's all good to read, but books of Ezra and Nehemiah are actually stories. Ezra was an older Obi-Wan Kenobi type who came back and they listened to him. He would read and give them wisdom. It's thought that he even organized the scriptures the way that we have them now, that he was responsible for what we call the Old Testament canon. That may or may not be true. It's thought that he finished the books of Moses, you know, the parts that took place after Moses died. Someone had to write them who wasn't Moses. And it's thought that Ezra, the scribe, did quite a bit of that. Nehemiah was more the Han Solo type. He was a warrior. He built with one hand and had a sword in the other and encouraged people to do that. And they also chastised the people of Israel because immediately after they came back, they started breaking God's laws. Immediately. So it's a fascinating story, and I think you should read it, and you will realize that this long history of the people of God actually took place. And this part of it you can verify. The fourth and last thing that I want to talk about is the fact that all over the world, people are looking for something more. They see what's on the face of the earth, and yet they find the need to go into their churches. And even though they're keeping days that are wrong and don't make sense, they're looking for more. When their loved ones die, they don't just put them out with the other garbage. That's not the way we do it. We treat them with respect, and we often commend them to the Creator who put them on the earth in the first place. When people die, that's when people start thinking about all the big and good things that are going on. People all over the world, in whatever culture they are in, are looking for more. There are almost no cultures on the face of the earth that don't have some spirit tradition, a tradition of living on the earth but knowing that there was something else going on, that there were other beings who pulled strings. We make fun of the ancient Greeks for their gods, you know, the colorful stories about Zeus and Hera and Apollo and Diana and all the other gods, and we could say, how could people believe in that? Well, we, as I said, have Han Solo and Luke and Leia and things like that. You know, a guy in Indiana shot somebody this week for telling him the spoilers that were in Star Wars. I would tell you what he told him, but then you'd be mad at me if you haven't seen the movie. But we do those things too. We have our own legends and myths and things that people get quite passionate about. But the point is that people are looking for more. They're looking for stories. They're looking for superheroes. They're looking for an answer. And also, people all over the world, for some reason, have the desire, well, not all people, of course, but they recognize that there is a morality in life, a way that humans ought to live. They disagree on what it is. But can you think of a nation that doesn't believe that killing is wrong or that stealing is wrong? When it gets into things like marriage, that gets a little more complicated and we see things falling apart. But the fact is, people are arguing about the concept of marriage. And marriage is not just a human concept. It's something that was given to us. And it means a great deal to people whether they come up with the right answer or not. Tay and I did go to see Star Wars. there were, I think, 8 previews to begin with, and we were so tired after the 8 previews that the rest of the movies just kind of slid by us. But the thing that struck us was all of these movies talked about the destruction of the Earth and people who were zipping in on spaceships to save them. And the special effects are amazing. It just made me want to just watch a Judi Dench movie where they just sit around and talk or something. But the thing is, that's the stories that are on people's mind, is that the Earth was being destroyed and people come to save it. That's a primal story for humanity. And that there is right and wrong, and that right needs to triumph and wrong needs to lose. And of course, they're confused as to how it happens, and we need to show them that way. Where did my sermon end up? Warriors game. I'm not sure how relevant this quote is anyway. But here's a quote from one of our superheroes. His initials are LB and his last name is James. LeBron James. He's from Akron. Here's a quote from LeBron James on December 4th. At a post-game appearance with reporters on December 4th, James was asked if the return of 2 injured players, which I think was Kyrie and Iman at that point, would help his team, the Cleveland Cavaliers. To the surprise of some who have questioned his faith, James's response was this: "I hope we don't think that way. It's never that way," he said. "When you get your guys back, you prepare just as you prepare before. There's only one guy ever in the world that everything will be all right when he comes back, and that's Jesus Christ. Other than that, you can't bank on nobody being okay." I'm not saying we should follow LeBron James as a spiritual leader. I'm not saying that we should even copy his grammar. But the fact is, people know that. We were at a Catholic funeral a couple weeks ago. Maybe it was only a week ago. It seems like there have been so many. And although these people believe that this person died and either went to heaven, hell, purgatory, or limbo, I get a little vague because I wasn't raised in that tradition, but he's somewhere. We don't want him to be nowhere. Al is somewhere. But then they started talking about the resurrection. What's with that? If you're already in heaven, what do you need with a resurrection? Well, they know that there's a story. You people know it because you keep God's holy days and you know what his plan is. All I wanted to do today was give you a little bit of ammunition for those times when you just wonder, am I on the right track? And I want to read to you out of the book of Romans. I will read to you from this Bible, because I'm going to read to you out of the Message, the translation called the Message. And I want to read to you from Romans 1, and you know these verses. In the Old King James, these verses start out with the phrase, "For even the Gentiles," and you know what it's about. Even the Gentiles have a knowledge of God, but I like the colorful way that this translation puts it. And you'll think, oh, the Bible does not say that. And if you follow along, you'll see that the Bible can say what the Message says, that there's more than one possible translation. But I just want to start. I think I'm in verse 19, but this translation is very vague about exactly where you are in the text. So I think it's verse 19. And it says, "But the basic reality of God is plain enough. Open your eyes, and there it is. By taking a long and thoughtful look at what God has created, people have always been able to see what their eyes as such can't see. They see the unseen, eternal power, for instance, and the mystery of his divine being. So nobody has a good excuse. What happened was this. People knew God perfectly well, but when they didn't treat him like God, refusing to worship him, they trivialized themselves into silliness and confusion so that there was neither sense nor direction left in their lives. They pretended to know it all, but were illiterate regarding life." What Paul is saying is that people really have no excuse, that the evidence was there. It's just that we have scales on our eyes and we can't see it, and we need help seeing it. I want to end with a passage also from, I think this is the passage I want, from Romans in the book, in the Message, But this is Romans 15. Those of us who are strong and able in the faith need to step in and lend a hand to those who falter, because sometimes we do falter, but we have to remember the things that make us know that it's true. Lend a hand to those who falter and not just do what is most convenient for us. Strength is for service, not status. Each one of us needs to look after the good of the people around us, asking ourselves, how can I help? That's exactly what Jesus did. He didn't make it easy for himself by avoiding people's troubles, but waded right in and helped out. I took on the troubles of the troubled, is the way the scripture puts it. Even if it was written in scripture long ago, you can be sure it's written for us. We have the added knowledge that comes from the scriptures. It's a gift God has given to us. Not everyone had it. You know, they didn't exist in the form that we have 2,000 years ago, but we have them now. God wants the combination of his steady, constant calling and warm personal counsel in Scripture to come to characterize us, keeping us alert for whatever he will do next. May our dependably steady and warmly personal God develop maturity in you so that you get along with each other as well as Jesus gets along with us. Then we'll be a choir, not our voices only, but our very lives singing in harmony in a stunning anthem to the God and Father of our Master Jesus Christ. And I think now it's time for a hymn.